So I basically made a decision to sell everything and to align my life with my values, which is to be free.
What exactly is it that compels someone to leave a place where they've lived most or all of their life?
And I'm not paying for any of that legacy that you guys have convinced everybody that we need.
Eventually, you're not gonna be able to afford a bag of potato chips. There are real world implications to the national debt.
When I come back here to Australia, I just see people in this prison in their brain that they have to have this intermediary. They have to ask permission constantly for everything.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Adam Hudson. Adam is a good friend of ours at the Bitcoin Way. He's an awesome guy, and he unveils everything you need to know. If you're considering a Plan B residency, how he landed on Panama, we talk about Bitcoin, what it means for him. He gives three unpopular opinions at the end. This was a fantastic conversation. Stick around to the very end. You're going to love my chat with Adam. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Adam Hudson here with me. Adam, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Mate, it is always a pleasure to be back with you guys. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. I'll tell you what, I owe you a huge apology. We have been talking offline. We've got group chats going on. You've done live streams with us. You did a documentary on your experience in Panama. And I'm just now reaching out and saying, hey, you should come on the podcast. So I can't wait for this conversation. We got a lot of ground to cover, but thank you for being patient with me, and I'm excited. So let's talk about the journey that you've been on. You've described what you have done over the last, I actually don't really know the timeline. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, but you've escaped Australia and you have found freer waters elsewhere. I would love to know, I think maybe a lot of people are curious, what exactly is it that compels someone to leave a place where they've lived most or all of their life? What are some of the insane things that you experienced? What was it where you said, enough is enough, I've got to leave?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been doing pods. This story of mine has become a really interesting subject for a lot of people in the West. And I've just seemed to be getting booked for pods back to back to back. Like, Adam, what did you do? Like, I'm the guy that kind of threw a hand grenade into the Western dream. And for those people who are just meeting me for the first time, I basically am a 30-year business guy from Australia, as you can probably tell. I'm actually in Australia today, but I'm rarely here. I'm just here for 4 days. And I had the perfect life at the end of the perfect life from a Western mind at the end of 30 years. I had the $7 million house on the beach paid for. I had multiple industrial buildings with gyms and churches and, furniture companies and all kinds of tenants in there. I owned a large caravan park with a couple of hundred tenants in there, which I still own that asset today with a friend. And I had, all these things, right? I had the beautiful new cars, the Ferrari, the brand new Porsche, all that stuff. And I woke up one day and I had to answer a question that had been quietly in my mind that I didn't want to answer because I knew the answer. And that was, are you happy? And the answer was, I'm not happy. And it was really hard to say because I should have been. And that's the thing about this kind of situation is that you feel like you are ungrateful, or you feel like that you've got no excuse or no reason. But I realized I was it was a big question that needed to be answered in my life. Why aren't you happy when you've achieved all these types of things? And it ultimately led me back to a single question, which was, why did I start on this journey? Like, why did I begin trying to be a businessman and an investor and all of this stuff? And my thoughts went right back to when I was at my first personal development seminar, which was with a guy called Jim Rohn, which was Tony Robbins' original mentor. And he came here to the Gold Coast where I am today. And it was the first time I'd even learned about goals. I didn't even know what goals were, right? Because I came up in a working class family. I hadn't been exposed to personal growth and goal setting or anything. And he asked us to write down, how do you define success? And but for you. And I at that time wrote something down, which came back 30 years later. And that was, my definition of success was to be able to go to the airport and to look up at the departures board, look at all these destinations, none of which I'd been to in my life. I could see Paris and I could see Nairobi and I could see Los Angeles and all these places. And I thought, I want to be able to go up, pick a place on the board, go to the business class line, buy a ticket, and then buy my clothes when I get there. That to me is success. I want to see the world. I want one thing, and that is freedom. And it came back to me like a ton of bricks that I had actually built myself a beautiful prison here in Australia. I had all these buildings, all these people, tenants that weren't paying on time. The Western mind was constantly about more, more, more. But we don't stop to ask why, for what reason are we doing these things? And that sort of started me down this rabbit hole. Now, I'd already been a Bitcoiner at this time. So sort of boiling in the background was this thing that I just, once I got orange pilled, I my intellect, the only thing that I really started to lean into and feel passionate about was Bitcoin. So at the same time that my faith in the Western way of thinking was falling, my interest in Bitcoin was growing, because Bitcoin is freedom money. So I basically made a decision to sell everything and to align my life with my values, which is to be free. And as a result of that, I went on that journey of self-sovereignty beyond just stacking Bitcoin. I'd been stacking Bitcoin since 2017. And I sold all my real estate except for the one piece of property that I own with a friend, because he's the majority owner. I'm the minority owner, and he wanted to keep it. And I dematerialized my life. And then I went on an adventure. And for the last 14, 15 months, I just traveled the world. As Jules says in Pulp Fiction, I'm just going to walk the earth. So I just walked the earth for a year, and I went to 14 countries. I went to Bitcoin Prague. I went to all the events, and I've had an amazing year. And I restructured my entire life around my values and living where I felt the best, living where my sovereignty was honored. And it wasn't easy, to be honest. It was really hard, and I'd be happy to talk about the hardship as well. But at the end of it, I was interviewed 2 days ago on a big podcast, and I said, tell us about the bad days though, Adam. You seem really happy now. Like, you seem like we've seen your journey. You seem, I said, now that I've worked it out, I actually am not having many bad days at all. I feel so alive and so happy and so aligned.
That's amazing. What were some of the, I assume along that path, like I've noticed for myself in Bitcoin, some of my values have changed, right? There are things that I used to believe about the world that I no longer believe. And I imagine 30 years ago, you set this goal and you sort of circle back to it, you know, 3 decades later. What in you had any of your priorities for what success might look like change? And how did that steer you as you thought about traveling the world, as you thought about where you might land? You know, what did that look like?
Well, you're a bit younger than me, Michael, but one thing that changed for me, a big catalyst, was also turning 50. So I'm 52 as I sit here today, and it hit me really profoundly on the day. That was another big catalyst in that story that I just told. And the reason that it hit me, like to be at 50 and not happy, was, you know, alarming. And it was particularly alarming for me because the most important person in my life was my mum. I had such a close relationship with my mother, beautiful, you know, the love of my life. You know, I grew up in a family where mum was home every day to greet me and my two brothers at the door when we got home from school. We lived in a pre-inflationary environment. We grew up in a time where the world enabled a family to be able to be raised on a single income. We would be able to have time with our mum, have time with our parents. And unfortunately, my mother developed a brain tumor and died at age 58, which is only 6 years from where I am today. And, you know, that was, you know, really sobering and a blessing in some respects to the value of life. And so at age 50, I started to go, you know, life is short. You must figure out how to find joy. That is the number one mission in your life.
I was wondering what of your values had changed that, you know, when you went on this journey, maybe you did it differently than you might have envisioned 30 years prior.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 30 years prior, you know, I went to and this is also just speaks to, I think, the impact of you know, the right voices and the right people around you is that, you know, I grew up in the West, you know, I grew up in that Western mind. And so the values were money, success, cars, you know, things like this. And so I pursued them and I got them. And I also, when I did get them, realized that none of that stuff actually brings me joy. What brought me joy is having freedom. And this then goes to why I love Bitcoin, and it is because freedom, I think, is something that's in it, it's it, you Americans are so, you have this so strongly embedded in at least your history, the value of freedom and the importance of freedom. And I think if you're not free, then it's very difficult to be happy. And you can be not free when you're a rich person with all this stuff that ultimately just ends up owning your mental bandwidth. And you wake up in the morning worrying about losing it, worrying about where the next expense is going to come from, worrying about how much tax is going to be due at the end of the month, worrying about all these things because you keep playing this game that is designed to keep making that money that you're earning worth less and less and less and less each year, just by a little bit, so that you need to work just that little bit harder every year. And eventually, you know, you get to a point where, and then when you start making more, if you bought into this, you know, game, you go, oh, the car that I just bought, I need a better car. The apartment I just bought, I need a better one. The clothes I've got, I need the new trendy ones. And you start going on this sort of cycle, and it's a trap. And it's a trap that keeps you investing more and more and more of the one sacred thing that is above government, and that is your life force. It is your time on this earth that everybody spends without knowing the balance. And the really hard question of life is, how do you find peace of mind? How do you find fulfillment? And I can tell you right now, it's not in trying to pursue more and more and more. And today, I laugh because, you know, I've now figured out that I don't need much. Like I had all the fancy stuff. I have a $59 Casio watch. You know, I find most joy, like I spend a lot of my time in Bali, Indonesia, and my mode of transport is a $10 a day rented scooter. And I am far happier on that $10 a day rented scooter, feeling free, riding around in a country that is still so free in so many ways, than what I get driving around in a Ferrari or a Porsche here in Australia. I just got zero interest in what I know what comes with that whole narrative, that whole prison that we build for ourselves around the Western way of approaching things. Michael, I'm doing a talk at the moment that I'm putting together for, I'm speaking on stage in Cancun, Mexico, an event, and the title of the talk is Normalized Insanity. And the basic idea is that when I left Australia, the first place I went, I set up a structure in Cyprus, and I then moved to Panama with you guys. And I'm very happy in Panama. I'm sure we'll jump into it. But I recently am just unstitching the Cyprus structure, and I'm going through my Cyprus bank accounts with the Bank of Cyprus, right? And I'm looking at the bank fees, and like they're charging me 25 euros a month for low usage fee. So they're literally charging me for not using them. I'm like, hang on a second. Like, they're running a ledger. It's essentially a blockchain ledger, right? That it's not blockchain, but it's basically just counting. This person has this, transfers it to here, A, B minus, right? Like that's what a bank, it's just a database. It's a database that's probably not as secure as the Bitcoin network, and probably it isn't. It's centralized. It's operating at the whim of a government. They ask permission. They literally told me when I set it up, if you're sending any money to us, more than 10, not out. If you're going to send any more than $10,000 in, you have to notify the bank manager on this email address of the inbound transfer. Not only do I have to tell you when I want it out, I have to tell you when I'm going to put it in. And if I don't use my own money, you're just going to take it. And that's in the terms and conditions at the rate of €25 a month. They had an onboarding call when I started that they said, oh, welcome to the Bank of Cyprus. Please click here. It's important you have this onboarding call. And the call was just like, hi, Adam, are you all set up? I'm like, yes. And it was compulsory. And that was €25. And I'm like, how are people normalizing this, that I have to ask permission to go in, to go out, and I give them the right just to take my money for not using my money?
It's because until 2009, that was your option. If you wanted to operate in the world, that was the only choice you had, in any practical way, at least. I guess you could become Amish and trade silver and gold or something like that. But for the average person, you have to pay the fee because that's what you have to do. And most people just don't even know that Bitcoin is the opt-out. So Adam, what took you, so you decided I'm leaving Australia. It sounds to me like part of that was the beautiful story that you shared about waking up and saying, you know, why am I not happy? Let's get practical here for people who, I think there are a lot of people, you alluded to this, who are thinking about it. They want to know, what are the nuts and bolts of making this happen, of finding a new place? What are the tax implications? Like, how did you go about this process, land where you're landing? What were some of the hurdles that you had to jump over to get there? And just any sort of, just give people a sense as to how this works or how it worked for you.
So it's a practical decision, and you are going to cop some flack, because especially if you're in Australia, Australians have this mindset that, you know, They all accept in Australia that Australia is in decline, like many parts of the Western world right now. But they have this sort of false idea that they're going to stay and fight. Really, what are you going to do? You're going to comment on YouTube videos? Is that fighting? Like, if you want to fight, take your economic power elsewhere and send the message that, hey, I'm not playing your game anymore. You don't get to steal from me as a business model. And my family and my family's future wealth. That's really actually fighting. That's what takes courage. But they have this idea that it's going to stay and fight, and it's just another word for I'm going to stay and comply. And when you make the decision practically, if you're going, and this is important, if you're going to leave a country like Australia, you really have to leave. You can't sort of, you know, people watch these YouTube videos. If you stay in Australia and set up a structure in Panama or Cyprus or Dubai or something, and I'm just going to stay. You can't. You've got to leave, and you've got to actually build a life outside of the country you're in most cases. We're blessed in Australia in that we don't have, like you guys in America, where Americans get taxed on worldwide income no matter where you are. Most, in fact, I think all other countries in the world, if you leave and you're not drawing on the resources anymore, then you don't have to pay tax there once you've left. But getting out is expensive in most cases, because here in Australia, for example, you either have to sell your assets or you keep them. But either way, if you sell them, like I'm talking about real estate, share portfolios, Bitcoin, whatever you own, if you sell them and you're in profit, obviously it's going to create a taxable event. So in my case, I sold all my buildings and my home, and you're talking millions and millions of dollars. All of those had what's called capital gains tax, and I had to pay that capital gains tax to the government, and then I left and I no longer have assets in Australia for them to tax. So I had to pay those tax bills, and I had to realize those profits and pay the tax. If you keep them in Australia, we have a thing called a deemed disposal laws. So if you're saying to our tax office, guys, it's been great, but I'm out, they go, cool, let the value all your shit, and we're going to tax you as if you'd sold them. And that's called unrealized gains. They're basically, you know, bringing those tax forward now. Now, you can keep them and not pay that. But when you do and you're offshore, they're going to tax you punitively when you do liquidate them later. So you either make the decision to liquidate now and pay your taxes and then keep, you don't have to liquidate, but you just assess your estate, you pay the taxes, and you might have to sell some assets to pay the tax bill. But then you're out and you can compound tax-free, or you keep them and risk punitive sort of taxation at the end. For me, I decided, you know what, I'm done. I'm selling everything and I'm actually really going to go do this. And for that reason, I think it's important for people to really make sure that if they're going to go and they're going to actually do what I did and liquidate, they got to know that they're staying. Because if you jump out for, you know, 6 months and leave the country and you're all gung-ho because you watched the YouTube video, and then you're not prepared to go through that dip, because when you leave a country that you have spent your whole life in and you have all this infrastructure there and you know you don't love it, but you know it, and you get a whole bunch of certainty and comfort from that country, when you leave, all that comfort and certainty goes away. And it's exciting, but there are days where it's terrifying. If you sort of run back to that country, you've paid all your exit taxes because you did the deemed disposal laws and all that, you're not going to get those taxes back. you're done. So you got to make sure that you're out. So when people say to me, you flee the country, you're a tax avoider, I said, bro, if you saw how much tax I paid from liquidating my asset, you would not say that. And I'm not fleeing any, I'm not tax avoiding anything, because I no longer draw on the resources here. I'm not using the health system, I'm not driving on your roads. I'm, you know, elsewhere now. So practically, I think that's a very important consideration. And you've got to have very strong and real reasons for wanting to leave. And I do encourage people to, you know, just know that there are other parts of the world and other places in the world, but you've got to know yourself well enough to really know what lights you up inside and what's killing you inside, because the journey is not easy. And I did it with money and it's still not easy. So.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great way of framing it. So you made a documentary, I guess you might call it like a mini documentary. I think it's about 40 minutes long. When you touched down in Panama, your experience there, your experience with the Bitcoin Way team, onboarding, you covered a lot of ground in 40 minutes. Could you talk a little bit about, you came prepared for that. So what was the idea? What were you trying to tell the world with that video, and how did it turn out for you?
So I did this documentary to try and demystify and bring it down to like brass tacks for people, a way of thinking about exiting. And I broke it down to say there's three options. One, you can just do a plan A, which is you do what I did. You basically sell everything, pay your taxes, and then find a place you want to go, and then go and live in that place. And once you're over sort of 183 days in most countries, you become a tax resident in that country and you pay tax there, and that's that. So you choose a country that's, you know, you feel good about living in, that's got good tax structure and all this sort of stuff. But the part you got to be very careful of is you find a country that is a great place to live, that you really enjoy living there. You have this networks of like-minded people that you can network with. There's access to things that you want to do and all of that. And then plan B is where you stay in the country that you're in. So plan A is do that. You just choose a spot and go and you live a majority of your life there. Plan B is you stay in your home country and you basically find a place where you can get a long-term residency visa in that country, even though you're going to spend a majority of the time where you are now, for now. And you continue to, for example, be in the Australian tax system, pay everything you're owed, but you go over with you guys and you get your Panamanian residency in place. And the reason you do that is because the environment that the world we live in right now, Western governments are failing. They are going more and more and more into debt. They're getting more and more and more insane. I think everybody knows that there's another pandemic on the way, as they always say, the plandemic. When I went over to Panama with you guys, there was 50 of your clients there from all over the world setting up, a majority of them setting up plan Bs that didn't intend on leaving their country yet, but wanted to know that they had a second home that, and I don't mean a physical apartment or a house, I mean a country that if they turn up at the border because they've just announced compulsory mandate to vaccines, they can say, you know what, Australia, I'm out. I've got a permanent residency card to Panama. I'm going to get on a plane. And in 12 hours from now, I'm going to go through that gate. They're going to welcome me as a Panamanian resident. And here, they're not going to have that. And plus, they're not going to tax the shit out of me. So a lot of people are setting in place these plan Bs. And it also starts the clock if they decide that they want to get into a more permanent situation, if they want to get a passport or whatever. Once you become a permanent resident in Panama after depending on the way you do it, whether you buy property or whether you just do it through residency, 5 to 7 years, you can actually be naturalized and be a Panamanian resident, sorry, citizen, without having to give up your citizenship of origin. So that's another great plus about Panama, is that it's on the table to get a passport and get it without having to renounce where you're from, so you can keep both. And so that's plan B, right? So you give yourself the option, but you stay where you are. And plan C is sort of where I've ended, where is that I figured out that I'm in a blessed place where I have means. And so what I've done is picked a couple of places in the world that I love to live, not just one place. So I believe that if you can, having a couple of places that you spend time in each year gives you the opportunity to appreciate the great things about both places. So I have a home in the south of France, which is a place where I absolutely love. It's between Nice and Monaco on the coast there. It's a stunning home overlooking Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat. And so I have a home there. I'm building a beautiful home in Bali. These are two places that when I'm there, my heart comes alive. I feel incredibly alive and enriched when I'm in these places. And I have a home in Panama. But my center of life from a financial perspective is Panama. I bank in Panama. I have a home in Panama. I have a company in Panama, you know. And so my financial center of life is in Panama, but I spend time in France and time in Bali, but under neither circumstance enough to become a tax resident of those countries, because I'm a tax resident of Panama. And so plan C is, you know, I think the dream scenario where you have a center of life in a wonderful free country like Panama, where they're not interested in your income outside of Panama. They're not interested in capital gains on assets outside of Panama. And so, you know, that's the best of all worlds in my particular opinion. And you might be shocked, it's not as expensive as you think. Like, you know, I was able to buy my home in France and my home in Bali for half the price of what I sold my home in Australia for. So,
that's crazy. I think you talked about on the, I think it was on the live stream we did together, a center of vital interest. Can you explain that concept, and is that what you're describing when you talk about Panama being sort of home base for your financial life?
So when you escape, you know, you got to think, okay, I'm spending time in these places, and you got to get your own advice on this. This is not tax advice. This is just me talking. I'm just a guy on the internet. You do your own research, get your own advice. There's a few things. The first thing is, when you leave a place, the first tax question that I think is important is that where you've spent all your life, you've got to be able to show that you are no longer in that country. And I think that's fair, right? Like, Australia should be able to tax you if you're principally spending your time in Australia and your center of life is in Australia and you're, you know, you're using the benefits. There are benefits of Australia, right? Like, it's safe, it's clean, the hospitals are great. There's lots of great things about Australia. I just think it's a soulless, Western-minded place where everyone's driving around in cars trying to outdo each other and their personalized plates and all the rest of the bullshit of the West. So it's just no longer there for me spiritually, right? I'm just done. But if you're going to stay, then just stop complaining, pay your bill. That's the rules, right? So the first tax question is, you've got to be able to show, hey, no, I'm gone. I'm out. I come back to Australia 8 weeks a year. The rest of the time I'm gone. And as much as I don't like the Australian government, either side of politics, right? I think they're just, you know, horrible individuals in power. I do agree that if you're going to be here, pay your fair share. That's it. So you've got to be able to say, I'm gone, right? And so then the next questions become the places that you are spending time. They're going to say, well, okay, you're spending time here. Our rules are, if you spend 183 days a year here, then you're a tax resident. Okay, cool. So if you're not 183 days there, but like in France, I probably spend 3 months a year in the south of France, that's really not enough for them to go, oh, let's look at this guy. There's hundreds of thousands probably of people that have second homes in the south of France, right? They live in the UK, they live in Italy, they live in all parts of the world, and they have holiday homes in France. It's not unusual for somebody who's got some means to own a, like the home I bought off an elderly couple from Rome in Italy, and it's their holiday home. So it's quite normal. They're not going to look at me and go, oh, you're now a tax resident of France because you spend 3 months of the year here. No. Same in Bali. There's lots of people have second homes there and spend time there on holidays because they recognize that you that is at a place that that's what people do. They come in, they spend money and so on. So you've got to be able to, then if those countries that you're spending time in want to make an inquiry, what they're going to ask is, where is your center of vital interests? And I say, here's my home in Panama. Here's my utility bills. Here's my tax return. Here's my banking. I don't bank in, I don't have a bank account in Indonesia. I don't have a bank account in France. I have, you know, my center of vital interest, my financial life is Panama. So you've got to be able to set up a structure that is not fake, that's demonstrably that way. And so that's what I've done. And so I feel very comfortable with setting that up now, but it took me a while. I went to Cyprus and I initially started there and but there was just little nuances, and just one I'll share with you, like just the importance of detail. Like with Cyprus, when I first went there, you know, that the reason I was drawn to it is that you only have to be there 60 days a year under their non-dom program to be a tax resident. And I thought, fantastic. So I could spend 8 weeks a year there as long as you don't spend more than 183 days anywhere else. And I was like, that's perfect for me. I don't want to be anywhere for more than 6 months. But what they didn't tell me is that you cannot be away from Cyprus for any more than 90 days at any time, which fundamentally means that every 3 months you've got to be back in Cyprus. And Cyprus is a little Mediterranean island sitting between the Greek islands and the basically Israel and the West Bank, right? So now it's a beautiful place. It's a really interesting place. You can ski. You can go into the beautiful Mediterranean on the same day. It's a stunning island in the Mediterranean. But being there every 90 days is problematic because it costs me 10 grand every time I've got to fly there and back from wherever I am, if I'm sort of in the east or wherever else. So that means I've got to keep jumping on these planes and going back there every 90 days. And it was 12.5% tax, effective tax rate when I got there. It's now 15%. And, you know, it's sort of within that EU. And whereas Panama just offered a much, much better deal, a government that's much more freedom-oriented. Basically, you respect our people, you respect the laws, and we leave you alone. And great banks in Panama and so many other things. And a really affordable cost of living. My home there is not expensive. It's great. I have a home right on Parque Omar, just a little apartment, just a little one bedroom apartment on Parque Omar. It's like looking over Central Park. It's great. So that's how I'm structured.
I love that. Yeah, basically read the fine print as you're evaluating your options and make sure that you're comfortable with what it is you're going to do. And I would imagine too, thinking long term about what your setup could look like. Are you going to have multiple places where you spend significant amounts of time that might affect what it is you do and where you land as your center of vital interest as well? So what was the role? You liquidated a lot of assets that you had. My impression is you moved most of your wealth into Bitcoin. What was the impact on your ability to do what you've done because you had portable censorship resistant money that was outside of the clutches of the traditional financial system? Did that make it way simpler? Would it have mattered?
Look, it's an interesting one, and this will tie into an unpopular opinion, which I'll share with you in a minute, but one of the reasons that Bitcoin was such a great off-ramp was that here in Australia, our country is a property Ponzi scheme. The government derives so much money off the real estate market in Australia that it is my view that they are in cahoots with the banks to just keep it going. Property in Australia is like a national sport. Everybody aspires to own their own home here, and that's why Australians are so rich. Because they own real estate at a rate that's pretty much unrivaled in the world. It's one of the most robust property markets on earth. But the problem with real estate is it's rooted in the physical earth of Australia. And as a result, the Australian government can just continue to tax it. Banks can keep raising interest rates, finding ways to generate fees from it. In Australia, the average new house and land, so like where somebody buys a block of land and puts a new home on it, and there's a massive shortage in Australia at the moment. There's been a housing crisis here for some time. The average cost of the house and land that you're buying, a young couple that's trying to get their first, you know, home, they often buy a house and land package, 40% of the cost of that home is tax in one form or another. Think about that. In the middle of a housing crisis, 40% of the cost of them getting into their first home is tax. It's wild. And people are going to debate this in the comments, but when you go down that rabbit hole, I had the most popular politician in the country right now is a lady called Pauline Hanson. She's been a lightning rod, and I've had her on my pod. And she was the one that revealed this stat and backed it up with facts. But anyway, the Australian government has a voracious appetite for taxes off real estate. We have stamp duty. When you buy a property, it's tens of thousands or thousands of dollars to tens of thousands of dollars every time the property changes hands. So you could buy a property, you know, sell it the next day, stamp duty is due again, stamp duty is due again. The most egregious tax was, this is one of the things that broke the camel's back. Right now I'm on the beachfront here on the Gold Coast. They brought in on the Gold Coast a view tax on your property. So if you are over level 3, they charge you a tax for the view. And it shows up on your rates notice, right? Which is, there's land tax and then there's local council tax. And it was ridiculous. So my home was on level 3. So I got in just under the threshold. So I have a $7 million home on level 3. They're basically one per floor apartments, and mine was right on the beach, probably one of the most prestigious buildings in the whole Gold Coast on a strip of land with 21 blocks and maybe 4 billionaires out of 21 blocks. So I live there. The guys across the road, like back from the beach, that were looking out over the mountains, not over the sea view, which is the premium, if they were on level 4 in an apartment worth $1 million, they still got taxed the view, even though I'm on the sand with this rock star view because I'm on level 3 and below. I dodged the tax. It's just wild. I'm just that they can literally charge you for the view. It doesn't matter what the value of the home is. Just stupidity. And so property investors in Australia just get absolutely smashed with taxes left and right. And I know there's going to be people in the comments going, screw this guy, listen to his rich person problems and all this sort of stuff. Because they fail to just see the morality of it. They sort of think that, you know, because you got money, you got given it. No, I sacrificed 30 years of my life to get to that position, right? But at the end of the day, it's a moral question. So being able to off-ramp into an asset where, you know, I don't have that, it's not jurisdictionally based, being able to, you know, if I don't like the rules, I just leave, right? As long as I've got my infrastructure, which is portable, I can go anywhere that I'm treated best. And I did off-ramp some into Bitcoin, but I also, the unpopular opinion is I think that it still behooves people to realize that there are other great transformations happening in the world, not just in Bitcoin. And I think it's good to have some assets outside of just Bitcoin. And I do, but they're not physical. I got investments in other things.
So you're not a shitcoiner, are you, Adam?
No.
I'm just kidding. But by virtue of your lifestyle, though, you want things that are portable, non-physical, yeah. At least most of the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
For me, real estate is a utility. And I think for Australians listening to this, Australians are so programmed that real estate is an investment vehicle. And that's the problem. It's got this inflated value because it's a means of making wealth. And homes were never meant to be a means of making wealth. Homes were meant to be a utility, something that you required in your life. You need shelter over your head. But because the Australian government's turned it into an investment opportunity, now the price of these things has just priced out so many people. And that's really sad because a home is a necessity that everybody should be able to afford.
Yeah. So, I think that makes a lot of sense. But and by the way, it's not just Australia. I mean, home ownership is the I would be very surprised if it's anywhere near 40% that's taken in taxes and fees in the US, but it is it's the American dream. And to be fair, I don't see any reason most people shouldn't be able to afford a home. I think that's a perfectly reasonable goal if your goal is not ultimate flexibility to travel all the time wherever you want. there's plenty of new technology and construction capabilities and plenty of land here in the US where there's not a scarcity problem, right? That drives prices up. It is a central bank, overregulation, local ordinances, all of those things that wreak havoc in the housing market. And so people become convinced that my home is my, like, I remember my best friend was buying a house a few years ago. It was the first home. And he told me he was talking to his real estate agent. He's like, I want to buy like a good investment that I can sell, you know, 5 or 10 years down the road when we're ready to move. And I told him, I said, first of all, your real estate agent has no freaking clue. Like, he just wants to sell a house and earn commission on this. But second, your home is going to suck a ton of money out of you because you're going to want to redo the bathroom. And then you're going to have a baby and you're going to need to buy furniture for this and you're going to need to maintain the lawn. And that's fine. I own a home, but it's not an investment. Maybe I'd come out ahead if I sold it. But if I didn't, that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to build a life and have a family and a place to live and to shelter me from storms. And like that, it really ultimately just comes down to that.
It's a trap for young people who are trying to build wealth. Australia, the Hail Mary, our stupid government that we have at the moment, they just dropped home deposits. They're going, we're going to make housing more affordable by reducing, because it used to be, you know, 10% minimum deposit. So this Looney Tunes government, this lefty Labor government we have at the moment said, we're going to make housing more affordable by dropping the minimum deposit from 10% to 5%. So you only have to save up half as much before. And the other thing they're going to do, I don't know if it went through or not, but they instructed banks to ignore student debt. So any repayments on student debt cannot be taken into account in their ability to service the loan anymore. Whereas previously they had to account for, okay, they've got to pay this student debt down, so their loan serviceability ratio is much lower when you remove that. And like the uneducated people go, yay, now housing's affordable. And the government, we're like, yeah, see, like we predict that by doing this, it'll only result in I think they said it was something like 5% increase in the cost of homes because we'll have new buyers in the market over 5 years. Well, homes spiked by like 15% in the first 6 months. So
shocking.
Right. So, you know, like the cost of the homes went up 15%. And these young kids who are getting into the market now have 95% debt, right? Not just 90%. So now they're in jail for even longer and they're under way more stress because they've got a bigger mortgage payment that they shouldn't be approved on because the student debts were being ignored as well. So you've got these people who are just like now gripping their steering wheels, driving around going, oh my God, I'm in so much debt for the next 30 years. And they're just hoping that the Ponzi keeps going because if it doesn't, they're screwed. And this is the antithesis of what the nature of human life is about, which is about freedom and joy. And if you want to build wealth, I look at things like Bitcoin and go, just look at the history, like look at the journey, look at the, you know, like there are much, much better assets if you than real estate, if you look at it from a holistic point of view. And then buy a house a little bit later when you've created wealth.
Right. So Adam, we were talking offline before we hit record about the price action. People are kind of, you know, down in the dumps about it's, you know, we've been bouncing around the $60,000-$75,000 range. And I don't want to ask you about for price predictions. What I'm curious though is you brought it back to, you said ultimately it comes down to certainly education and conviction, but this low time preference behavior that is instilled when you study Bitcoin and when you begin to learn about money, real money. I'd love for you to maybe follow up on any comments you had on that, because I think that's a really important point because it relates to a lot of the things you're describing here. People striving for this home, striving for this or that and the bigger car, and they're making these decisions for their, not only for their financial future, but also just for their immediate gratification. They're striving for joy or happiness. And it's all centered around what I think you would agree, perceive to be very high time preference behavior. It's not going to sustain them through life. What would you add to that?
Look, the superpower from an investing point of view that the rich have, that the poor don't, is a low time preference. right? So rich people have a massive cushion. And so they are able to just ride things out. They are able to just sit and chill. Whereas people who are still in the struggle, still in the matrix of life and getting up every day and not having enough, what do they say? Too much month at the end of the money. that's most people, right? Too much month at the end of the money. They need returns now. They need to grow now. And as a result of that, they aren't able to stomach volatility. They're not able to, when things go down, they panic. But we're also at that thing with Bitcoin as well. And it's that time where people are starting to realize that they've got stupid money. They've got money that becomes worth less every year. And then on the Bitcoin side, you've got money that becomes worth more every year. And we're right at the end of it. Why would you need banks and need intermediaries? We're early there. You've got to understand what we're on the dawn of here. And we are seeing it in right now. We are seeing it like this whole thing in the Middle East. The question right now with this battle is, why are they fighting? Like, if America has oil security and doesn't need the oil because you're a net exporter of oil, why are you really there? Right?
So again, I ask myself that often.
Yeah. Why are you really there? Well, in my opinion, it's a fight over the petrodollar. They just want to make sure that all that oil that is going through is paid for in what? USD, right? That's my personal opinion. I think this is a war over the petrodollar, because that is the real risk to the United States, is that they stop, you know, transacting in the petrodollar. This is what, in my opinion, the fight's over. And so then that starts you down, what's the implications of that? And so again, it's broken money on display, and it's demonstrating in plain sight why fiat money is just so broken and so evil, because you guys are able to do what you're able to do there in the Straits and with all this military might by enslaving future generations of Americans by just printing money that you don't have. You guys are totally broke. You are a drunken, drug addicted hot mess. You're the uncle that's off the rails and just printing money like it's nothing. And the only reason you can do it is because the whole world takes USD. And the minute the whole world stops taking USD, Uncle Bob's going to have to go to rehab.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right. That's
not... And you guys get away with it because you've got this currency that everyone will accept, and you can just make it up out of thin air in many times at the cost of human lives and destruction around the world. And it's very sad. And I love you guys, and I love you, Michael. And it's not about American people. It's just about the way the world is.
Yeah, it is. It's very sad. And what makes it even harder and more sad is that I think most people hear these trillions of dollars of debt numbers thrown around, right? We're approaching $40 trillion in national debt. And they've just heard it climbing. And they're so undereducated that there might be an implication to that, that there might be a consequence at some point, right? It's just like, oh, well, it's been going up for forever and the world hasn't blown up yet. So yeah, I guess we're going to be $50 trillion in debt soon. It's like, no. Eventually, you're not going to be able to afford a bag of potato chips because of this. Like, there are real world implications to the national debt. They are going to have to monetize the debt. They're going to have to print. They're going to need yield curve control. They're going to throw everything at this, and you're going to pay the price. And then your kids are going to pay the bigger price. And, you know, it's, to me, that's why what we do when we talk about Bitcoin, Adam, and the work that you've done, you know, partnering with our team, I just think it's so important, because it's an education in all of those topics just by introducing them to sound money and in a better way of operating outside of the fiat system. So it's,
you need hard assets is what you need. And Bitcoin is the hardest of all assets. It's a finite supply. And I don't think people there's some remarkable things happening right now. I know an unpopular opinion amongst Bitcoiners is that, you know, Michael Saylor is an extremely polarizing character in the Bitcoin world. Some people hate him, some people love him. But one thing that guy is doing right as we sit here right now is constraining that supply. He is just buying, like, I don't know if you've seen the daily buys. Yeah. This is a guy buying $100 million plus a day of a limited asset. He is buying up the entire mining supply and then some every single day. And how is he doing it? He's doing it by turning the fiat system in on itself. These trillions of dollars that have been saved by people around the world, where in the past they only could buy bonds, he's offering them products that are Bitcoin basically backed, where he's saying, give me your money, I'll give you 11.2%. And the math on it is Bitcoin only has to go up by 2.2% a year in order for Michael Saylor to meet his obligations on the dividend side of these instruments he's creating. So he's created a vehicle that relies on the fastest growing asset in the history of assets to only go up at less than inflation, less than half of the published inflation rate, not the actual inflation rate. So you got the fastest horse. Like, Bitcoin has been the best performing asset every year, I think, except four since it started, with a CAGR of something like 40% or 50% annually. It only has to go up at half the published inflation rate for him to service the it's just wild. And people don't see this yet. And he's just sucking up supply, which is making it tighter and tighter and tighter. And ultimately, when this thing turns, I think it's going to be face melting.
Do you think his stretch product, just I see this all the time, and I don't really care too much. I buy Bitcoin, I take self custody. That's kind of my approach. It just makes my life simpler. Do you think his stretch product is going to be the fixed income retirement vehicle of the future? So people retire and they're like, I can't be in government debt. Like, this is, you know, I can't earn 3% when inflation's really 5% and make it last very long. And so they start buying his product and, you know, continue to outperform.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's of the future. It's happening right now. If you are not watching that Strike story, it is the most insane thing I've seen in a long time. The amount of money that's being off-ramped into that product. And then Michael's just taking it and putting it into Bitcoin. I think if you're a young person or anyone, you go, well, what's he doing with the money? He's buying Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So he's selling it to people who don't really maybe understand Bitcoin and don't want the volatility of Bitcoin. And he's saying, great, I'll take the volatility off you. Give me your money. I'll give you a nice fixed return that makes you feel all safe at night. And then he's off-ramping it into the real asset, which underpins the whole thing, is Bitcoin. So why wouldn't you buy the Bitcoin, right? Yeah. The aerospace engineer, this is what happens when you get an aerospace engineer and you say, go and play and study something. And he comes back and says, hey, I figured this thing out. Like, he's a seriously smart guy. And he says it, he's not hiding anything. He's like, if you want the ultimate, buy Bitcoin. If you want the second ultimate, buy MicroStrategy stock. And then if you want anything else in the stack, depending on what your appetite is. But at the very base of all of this thing is the Bitcoin. And I think that owning the Bitcoin and doing what you guys teach, which is the self-custody, I think in 5 years, as governments try to constrain and governments try to stop, that the two words that governments fear the most is self-custody. I think you're going to see a massive tightening, and rules and laws are going to try their best to stop people signing up with the Bitcoin way. Because you are teaching people how to move value at the base layer on the blockchain. I paid you guys yesterday. I bought cold card queues and different things. On the base layer, I went in with my own node and I transferred money without any oversight or interaction with a government-controlled entity like a bank or anything else. I was able to do all of that myself, right? As long as I've got access to a computer and a Wi-Fi, they cannot stop me. And that scares the shit out of government. So this ability to be able to store value and move it on the base layer, it's going to be like in the Matrix, the guys that the guy with the key that can take the back, you know, it the key master or something? He's the guy that could just open the door and go out the side and then come pop back into the Matrix. Everybody else is going to be operating within the Matrix. The government's going to say, well, look, we can't stop Bitcoin. We're seeing it with banks. Banks are now like JP Morgan. They're all releasing ETFs and they're all like, well, you know what? Bitcoin called their bullshit, called their bluff and says, oh, no worries, object, do whatever you want. You can't stop it. Putin said the same thing. You can't stop Bitcoin. So they're finally going, all right, if we can't stop it, how do we make money from it? And that's when they lean in with their government buddies and they start to regulate it. And they start, oh, you can't self-custody. Well, you can. And they might try to, that you can, but they can stop you if you stay in the country, maybe. They can put firewalls, maybe. But if you're actually a sovereign individual and you're moving around and you've got economic power on that base layer and you've got the technology and you know how to be free and you're using open source tools and you're using air-gapped wallets and doing all the stuff that Crazy Tony fucking teaches you the Bitcoin way, which is why I love Tony. He's totally fucking nuts. He's one of those crazy guys that's on the Nebuchadnezzar, right, teaching people and grabbing them with the steel claw out of the cesspool of the Matrix and pulling them onto the Nebuchadnezzar and dusting them off and saying, wake up, welcome to the Nebuchadnezzar. This is how you store economic value. This is how you move on the back roads. I jumped on the Nebuchadnezzar and I'm loving it. I sent a text in the group to you guys yesterday and I said, my three friends, I got them on their Bitcoin journey. And I said, look, I hired you guys because I know they'll take the training seriously if you teach them self-custody. But I also know that if they spend any time with you crazy bastards, they're going to be orange pilled hard by the end of it. But this is really really what you're doing. You're really taking people around like the Nebuchadnezzar and you're dropping the claw down, you're pulling it out of the soup. And you're saying, let's get that thing out of the back of your head, which tells you that you need to rely on the system the whole time. And you're just, in reality, you're sitting in this goop that is feeding shit into your head the whole time. You're not alive at all. You're being fed on. And, you know, when you learn self-custody, that's the day that the cord comes out, you get sucked down the pipe, and then you end up in the Nebuchadnezzar, and you're going to be able to move value at the base layer. And I think 50 years from now, people are going to go, you've got real Bitcoin? Like, you've got actual Bitcoin that you can access at the base layer on the blockchain? It's going to be like an illegal drug. And and those transactions are going to be like, holy shit, this bro over there, see that guy over there in the black coat? He's got like real legit Bitcoin. I know it sounds a bit of a fantasy, but it's just like, I just think that's where it's heading. I just think the governments just hate the fact that you can actually move value and there ain't shit they can do about it. One thing I just want to say quickly on that, like when I was in Panama, I was looking at buying a property and, you know, I said to the agent, she said, the number one thing, Adam, is going to be moving the money into Panama. It's going to be challenging. And then you guys said, no, it's not, because you bank with this bank. You sent me up with a bank that actually opened a Bitcoin account. So I got my checking, savings, and Bitcoin account. And you said, just transfer some Bitcoin in to the bank directly. And I was like, oh, shit, you can do that in Panama, right? Like any other channel in, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to say, you know, wire 200,000 US or whatever to Panama. And they're going to say, we want proof of funds. Please show us a contract. Show us the title, the all the shit, right? Bitcoin, they can't do shit. I can just, here's the address to send the 200,000 of value. It's there. 10 minutes later, done.
Yeah, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. It's truly a beautiful thing. When you, I was thinking about this recently. My wife, we had to upgrade our car because we got our fourth kid coming and didn't have room for four. So we got her not a new car, a used new car. And I'm trying to figure out how to pay this guy on a Friday when we hadn't landed on what the trade-in value was going to be and all that stuff. I told my wife, I said, If we could just pay him with freaking Bitcoin, he could send me a QR code and I could just send him the money right now. He'd have it in 10 minutes or less and we'd be golden. Instead, I'm trying to figure out, do we have time to initiate a wire? Do we or do we need to wait till Monday because the bank's closed tomorrow? So it's like but most people just take that headache and they're like, oh, well, I guess that's just how the world works. And it's like, yeah, only if you're living in fiat.
That's why my talk later this year is called Normalized Insanity. Because once you've used the smartphone, you're like, what are you doing with that stupid phone with all the buttons and all the crap on it? Like, yeah. Bro, like yesterday when I got the invoice to pay you guys for three self-custody setups for my family and my best mate, I texted you and I said, boys, I just disconnected my Bitcoin node, which was sitting in my house in Australia, which I've sold. I just literally pulled it out in the morning. and I needed to the node to to just, so I was like, oh, screw it. So I just went back to the house, plugged the Bitcoin node in, banked 5 minutes later. And that Bitcoin node connected to the back of any Wi-Fi router. And so I just quickly ducked home, plugged it in. I'm back online. I'm good to go. I transferred the payment to you, and then I pulled the node back out and carried on. But imagine if you disconnected your bank account, the rigmarole of like disconnecting it. Like I literally have had to send like just to close my Bank of Cyprus account to get my 800 euro deposit back. I had to print this document off in Bali, physical paper, sign it, get it witnessed, and put it on a DHL courier for $150 and send it back over to Cyprus in the middle of the fucking ocean just to close the bank account with my own money in it.
Crazy.
It's just wild what we've normalized, the theft that we've normalized with these clowns that have an inferior centralized mechanism. And you look around, you go into Panama and you look around at the sky. What do you see on the side of all those high-rise buildings? Banks. They're all banks or insurance companies, every single one of them. Who's paying for that shit? You're paying for the building, and you're paying for all the people that work in that building. Where's Bitcoin's building? There is no Bitcoin building. There is no Bitcoin employee. That's why I was able to pay you guys so fast yesterday. And I think I paid, 100 sats, 10 cents to send. For all of that, I'm not paying for any of that legacy shit that you guys have convinced everybody that we need. Bitcoin says, we don't need all that. We've actually got a more elegant, more secure solution that you can control. Everybody does their little bit and we all save together. And it's just so infuriating when you sit there. And the real estate agent, when I was saying, you can't pay in Bitcoin. And then when I said, actually you can, I'm going to pay it into this bank that the guys at the Bitcoin wages set up as Bitcoin. The bank will just flip it into currency for you and you can have it. She went, really, you can do that? And I was like, yeah, because in all of a sudden now her incentives are aligned. She's going, hang on, my clients who have been screwing around for weeks and weeks and weeks trying to get their money into Panama to be part of this amazing economy and rules set up can now transfer that value in 10 minutes and they don't have to go through all this bullshit. Tell me more about that, right?
And that's so that's the world. That's how you do
the
it.
The moment that their incentives are aligned and they go, and I say, Yeah, it's just so wild to me. And people have this idea that you can't buy anything with Bitcoin. I'm like, bro, I've bought real estate with Bitcoin, cars with Bitcoin. So I could pay you like that without any permission or bullshit. And that's why, Michael, your talk was so important in Prague, where you were trying to convince people, don't just buy this stuff, use the stuff. And I lost my cool the other day on a podcast. And I said, if you have not actually used Bitcoin, then don't have an opinion of what Bitcoin's worth because you don't know. Just shut the F up, because until you've actually experienced what it's like to transact value without the banking infrastructure, you don't understand what you're talking about. You don't understand, like, Bitcoin does nothing. I'm like, except save you from the most corrupt, evil, freaking cohort cartel in the world. Except that. Except gives you a complete alternative to being screwed every day. It does nothing, you idiot. Yeah. Of course it does something, you clown. Like it's the most revolutionary thing. Money sits at the base of all of our lives. We wake up every day and it's the number one thing is, how am I going to make it? How people look down the right-hand side of menus, decide how hungry they are because of money.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Adam, I want to head for home here. So you've already alluded to, I think, two of your three unpopular opinions, maybe. One of them was Michael Saylor, perhaps. The first one was that there are other investments besides Bitcoin that are still worthy of being made. You're free to elaborate on either or both of those, but I think you said there was a third one. You told me offline.
Yeah.
Three.
I wrote down three because I know you guys are crazy Bitcoin maxis, and I love that about you. I love you guys are my Nebuchadnezzar. You're these crazy shaved head bastards that spend your day flying around pulling people out of the goop, and I love the shit out of the Bitcoin way for that. And
okay. Come on, Adam, dump it on me, man.
Well, as I say, I think Bitcoin's amazing. I think Elon Musk is a generational, not just generational, I think he's the most incredible entrepreneur that has ever walked the earth. And I think he's creating changes in the world that are profound And I think that there are other, and there are a few other, very, very few other investments that are happening on planet Earth right now that can give you, that can even help you on your Bitcoin journey by having a little bit of diversity into things that align with your values and that just give you a little bit of a broader footprint. So I think it's okay to have a little bit of diversification outside of just Bitcoin only if you want. So like, for example, I have Tesla. I don't have a lot of assets, but I have Tesla, and I'm not here to pump Tesla stock. I just, I'm 52, and I met Elon Musk in 2012, and I saw Amazon. I made a lot of money out of Amazon early, and I saw these two incredible entrepreneurs, Jeff Bezos, and I met Elon, and I went out and I didn't invest in either of those companies. I was like, I went and invested in myself. Like, how dumb is that? So I was like, I think that when you see true innovation, Bitcoin is true innovation. I think many things Elon is doing at the moment is true innovation. So I think, you know, learning to just, you know, go down some rabbit holes. There's some very interesting things happening in the world right now that are good, you know, fiat-based investment opportunities as well. But as long as they align with your values. The second one was spend Bitcoin, which we've already talked about. Like that's an unpopular opinion with some people. They're like, just stack sats and chill. I'm like, no, bro, like remind yourself of what the initial intention of the white paper was, which was to use it as a means of exchange. So use it as a means of exchange. You can always dump more, instead of just going and paying your bills, you know, in fiat, pay as many of them as you can in Bitcoin and then just buy more Bitcoin to replace it, because it's in the using of it that your conviction about what it is, because you're reminded, oh my God, Satoshi gave us an iPhone in a world full of stylus pens and buttons that retards use, right? Like that's, you know, Elon's given us a car that is just opening the world to so many other options, safer driving, an income source. People who are immobile can now get mobile. Like he has changed the entire meaning. It's not quite there yet, but give it 5 years and the question is going to flip. Why would you buy anything else? And we're at an iPhone moment with Bitcoin where we're going to be like, why would you, young people, the next generation, when these old dinosaurs die off, they're going to, why would you store your money in a term deposit in fiat that's being deflated to nothing when you can put it into Bitcoin? Like that just seems dumb. You're right. Like, so, but the spending the Bitcoin piece is important because you are reminded every time I use the stack that you guys teach in self-custody, every time I do it, it deepens my conviction, right? It's like if you drive a Tesla, you realize, oh shit, this is the future. I should invest in this company. When you use Bitcoin, you go, oh, why have I been, when you really use it at the base layer, how you teach it, not when you log into an exchange and then you go to your balance and you transfer it out of this third-party government-controlled company that's holding it on your behalf in the same way that your fiat currency is held by a bank. It's not yours. When you actually control the keys and you actually operate with open source software that you guys teach, that deepens your conviction. So use it. And the last one is, I think Michael Saylor is a genius. And I think what he's doing is showing, just taking the piss out of the fiat system and say, see your broken, screwed up system. I'm going to plug pipe straight. I'm going to mainline you into the good stuff. And then he's just buying up and all that's going to do. And he's buying that and throwing the keys away and going, it's never coming back out, because he understands this is a hard asset, is the digital base layer. And I think for everybody else that's smart enough to see what Michael's doing and buying the base layer, we're all going to benefit from that. I really believe that. So those are my three controversial takes. Own other things, spend Bitcoin as well. And be grateful that if you're buying direct Bitcoin and putting it into cold storage and self-custody, you are following one of the smartest guys that I've ever seen walk the earth.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. And, you're going to hit different people. We'll find that this certain ones unpopular, but I think the big one that I can rally around is spend Bitcoin, because I think Bitcoin is a tool for a better world, but I think it requires us using that tool. And one way that we use it is we get other people, we get in everyone's hands that we possibly can. And if that's your local farmer, your church, your synagogue, your wherever, and they begin to recognize these, some of these concepts that you've described very eloquently here, that they have uncensorable money. They can do what they want with it when they want. They plug in a node, they can send privately. I think that's the when we begin to see the tides turn and the world begin to heal from some of the brokenness of fiat. So I think those are great, man. And I want to give you a chance to provide a handoff here. There, you've got a fantastic podcast. You've got a lot of things going on. I'm gonna I'll let you tell people where they can find you. But I'm gonna link in the show notes to that 40-minute documentary that you did on Panama. I'll even link to the live stream we did, which is unlisted on our YouTube channel, so you can't find it unless you registered. But we'll make that available here on this video as well. So, Adam, where would you send people?
The best is probably Instagram. I update there now and then, which is Adam Hudson Official. And I run a podcast, which is called Unemployable. I just do the Bitcoin content now, and I do the stuff about people relocating overseas. That channel does other stuff as well, but you'll see my face on the videos about Bitcoin and about sovereign living, which is really the things that I'm most interested in intellectually these days.
Perfect. Adam, this has been a blast, man. I'm glad I finally got you on. Appreciate your time, and we will catch up very soon, I'm sure.
Absolute pleasure, man. Thank you.
Cheers, brother. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Adam. Do me a huge favor. Go follow him on Instagram. If you're there, go check out the documentary linked in the show notes below. Really fascinating deep dive into his process getting into Panama, everything that we sort of discussed here, but in more detail. And of course, we would really appreciate it. If you've been enjoying the podcast, do me a huge favor. Give us a like, subscribe, share it with someone who you think might be interested, comment on the video. We really appreciate it. You helping feed the algorithm to share and spread the bright orange signal with the rest of the world. And of course, if you need help taking proper 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin, as Adam described, very important on this journey. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'll talk you through how we help, what it is we do, why it's so fundamental if you are a Bitcoiner. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. And again, we have this Plan B residency option. Lots of people all over the place who are looking to get out of these insane tax policies, authoritarianism, surveillance state nonsense that we're seeing increasingly in the world. So go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to learn more. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.